Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, world. This is the Global Media and Communication podcast series. I am Aswin Punathambekar, the director of the Center for Advanced Research in Global Communication.
This is Jing Wang, the senior research manager at CARG.
Our podcast is part of a multimodal project powered by CARG here at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania.
At CARG, we produce and promote critical, interdisciplinary, and multimodal research on global media and communication. We aim to bridge academic scholarship and public life, bringing the very best scholarship to bear on enduring global questions and pressing contemporary issues.
Welcome to the Global Media and Communications Podcast. I am Ignatius Suglo, a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Advanced Research in Global Communication, and your host for today. Joining us today is Thomas Chen, an assistant professor at Lehigh University and the author of the book Made in Censorship, The Tiananmen Movement in Chinese Literature and Film. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you so much for having me, Ignatius.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you today, and thank you for making the time. So before we, continue, can you just begin by telling us a little bit more about yourself and your research interests?
Sure. I am currently an assistant professor of Chinese at Lehigh University. My story, I guess, begins in Beijing, where I was born. I came to the U.S. when I was 7 and a half. My parents and I moved quite a bit between the states of Pennsylvania and California. Eventually, I did my undergrad at Cornell. After graduation, I worked for a few years, including as a reporter. And then in 2009, I started a PhD at UCLA. And after that was completed, I came to Lehigh, where I teach and write on modern Chinese literature and film.
Oh, that's great. So what sparked your interest in the Tiananmen movement, particularly, and how did this project come about? I mean, what was your journey leading onto this project?
Thanks for that question. I didn't settle on Tiananmen in the beginning. It was somewhat of a circuitous journey. Very early on in my PhD tenure, I was drawn to the subject of censorship. And it was only later on that I realized why. It's because of my experience as a reporter. So after graduating from college, I worked as a police reporter at a local newspaper in, of all places, Lansdale, Pennsylvania. And that was certainly an exciting job for a young person, right? Right out of college, to be on the police beat, to cover breaking news. But it was also exhausting, and I quickly burned out. Right before I started my PhD at UCLA, I actually interned, you could call it interning, you could call it being a part-time correspondent for two media companies in China. The first is 21st Century Business Herald, 二十一世纪经济, Baodao. I worked there for a few months, and then I worked for the English service of China Radio International, CRI. It was those experiences, on hindsight, that made me interested and perplexed about the complex workings of censorship. Of course, when I first started grad school, it was such a large topic, right? You start with Plato and the Republic and what is implied about censorship there. But only after quite a few years did I hone in on the subject matter I eventually arrived at.
Nice. So before we go into, you know, the meat of, you know, the book and the nitty-gritties of it, what is the main argument, or what do you hope that people who read this book take away from it?
Sure. The main argument is simply that censorship needs to be viewed as a productive, formulative force in addition to a repressive, subtractive one. So when we think about censorship, we generally think of something that deletes, cuts out, bans. But what I want to emphasize with my book project is that it's also very shaping of narratives, of the stories that we tell. So it's not only leaving certain voices unheard or unspoken, silencing certain voices, but broadcasting and promulgating authoritative or official discourses. So there's a duality I wanted to tease out with my book.
Yeah, no, that's great. And, you know, talking about your own work as a reporter early on also kind of shines a bit more light on some things that I was thinking about. And, you know, the Tiananmen movement and its aftermath, right, have been viewed as, or it is a lot of things, right, to different people in different places. And you engage with it as a media event, at least from my understanding, right? And you provide a deeply contextualized media history of the movement and its aftermath. And, you know, so I guess my question is, what informed your choice of literature and film as a way of looking at the Tiananmen movement?
Thanks for this question, Ignatius. There's several ways I arrived at Tiananmen. First and foremost is on the subject of literature and film. Those are my fields. Those are my passions. I love reading, especially works of literature. I love watching films. So it was natural for me to hone in on these media for this project. And related to the subject of Tiananmen, it's often believed in the Western Hemisphere that Tiananmen is a strictly a blank in the Chinese discursive world, that it cannot be talked about, that there's an utter silence on it. But looking at various works of literature and audiovisual production, whether that be TV programs or films, we see that actually it does, the event continues to live on in artistic afterlives. There are many artists, writers who continually engage and return to that central event for a variety of purposes. So its life, even within China, is very much vibrant and contested. And that's something that I wanted to reveal with the book.
Yeah, and so there is a whole range of media forms, right? From literature, through, you had novels, film, documentaries, one may say. And so what was the thinking behind the selection process of what do you analyze specifically?
My principal criterion in the selection of the materials and what I wanted to start the book with is to bring in government materials. I think these are materials that are seldom looked at in scholarship across the board,
right,
especially in literature and film studies. They are completely discounted, brushed aside because they are just low-grade propaganda, right? But in my view, they form a major part of the discursive context. there was massive output in literary and audiovisual materials in the immediate aftermath of June 4th by the government at all levels and in many different geographic locations. Centered on Beijing, to be sure, but you have pamphlets and books produced in Sichuan or Hubei, all over the map, essentially. And this kind of campaign, and it is really a media campaign in the news and publishing and on radio and television, this campaign needs to be studied and really delved into to show that instead of equating Tiananmen with silence, and in the immediate aftermath, where of course during the protests themselves, there was an inundation of words on the subject coming from the government. They wanted to very much spread and promote its version of the events. Who were the good guys? Who were the bad guys? Who were the actual heroes? What were the machinations behind the rise of these protests? So that's why my first chapter really wanted to explore this underlooked at facet of coverage.
Yeah, and you touched on silence, right? And I found it very generative that you ask us, the readers, to look beyond to break away from binary oppositions of looking at, silence as the opposite of speaking, right? And you write that silencing is not the opposite of speaking up, but working in tandem with speaking, right? And so since we're on the subject, right, I want you to just touch on the productivity of silences, but also of absences, right?
Thank you so much for this question. And we see the similar dynamic at play in recent protests in China, with people holding up blank sheets of paper, the so-called A4 protests, right? So there is something productive about blankness. Blankness in these kinds of contexts signal openness, signal possibility, and in certain situations, it's this openness, blankness, and possibility that constitute for the regime a threat. So here, silence, you could say, a form of silence, is performed by residents, by the people, to suggest voices that have been curtailed. So their demonstrative display of blankness speaks louder than, you could say, speaks louder than words even. And on the subject of silencing, we can look at it in a different light too. Again, returning to the immediate aftermath of June 4th, you have such a torrent of government speech, right? And this government speech also wants to see itself repeated and regurgitated. So in workplace discussions and school events, students and workers oftentimes had to account for their actions during the protest. So they had to give an account of themselves, to own up to their failings or their mistakes, and then pronounce their conversion into the righteous stance, right? So in those moments, to be silent, to not to regurgitate and repeat the official narrative, is also a form of protest. So not only should we valorize speech, but in particular situations, silence too is bravery.
Right. And that got me thinking about the silence of the government as well. The director of Summer Palace, lawyer, I believe, when he was interviewed about, you know, how some parts of his work was deleted, he remarks that nobody in the government has said that Tiananmen movement cannot be filmed. So how does that silence of, you know, government play into all these other types of silences? Is it also a strategy for the regime to, you know, have some form of control?
That's a wonderful perspective. And it really relates to the fuzzy borders of the censorship regime. It very much operates by unwritten rules.
Right.
By what people take for granted, what are supposed to be off limits. And it's because of the, you could say, the daring actions of certain writers and filmmakers who, by making particular films or writing a particular work, they challenge and, you could say, even confirm or affirm the place, the existence of these boundaries, right? If nobody speaks out, then we assume that maybe there is no restriction to begin with, right? But when there is conflict, when there is an incident, right? When a particular key word where subject matter infringes upon those sensitive borders, then those borders themselves are laid bare, are revealed that they do exist. And by pointing out those borders, you are also not only demarcating the boundaries or the terrain of censorship, but you also help to lay it bare so that others who come after you can push against those boundaries and even expand upon those boundaries or overstep even more knowingly those boundaries.
Yeah. And so about in relation to the fuzziness, right, of all this, I mean, I'd just also just like you to reflect a bit upon the non-staticness of what is considered sensitive within this context, right? In some part of the book, you talk about, you know, one thing that receives approval and is considered okay and fine. And in another time and space is considered, you know, not appropriate by the regime. And I think that was in relation to the work Flutter, Flag of the Republic.
Yes. And we see a similar dynamic play out recently. I just read a New York Times article on how scientific articles on COVID that were initially published by Chinese scientists were later retracted, withdrawn because of government pressure. So these are findings, scientific findings that, you know, at a certain time were allowed, right? They entered the realm of public knowledge that is partaken by the international community. But at a later point, certain officials or certain agencies in the government deemed these scientific findings to be too revealing or perhaps even incriminatory, right, as to the location and the time of when the virus emerged or was found out in Wuhan. So what was allowed at one point later became off limits and had to be taken out of circulation. And this is, of course, seen in relation to the Tiananmen protests too. In the government documentary that you pointed out, this documentary was made by the People's Liberation Army. So it had the utmost sanction, right? But over the years, because the audiovisual medium itself is so unruly, filled with images that can be used for a variety of purposes, right? It too became too provocative. It too had to be cut or edited in a way that certain elements could no longer be seen. So we really do see a temporal dimension to the strictures of censorship.
And you touched on the subject of COVID, which you talk about in your conclusion as well. And, you know, thinking about zhengnengliang, positive energy, right, as a mobilizing discourse, right, by the regime in talking about COVID. And this also reminded me of the use of the same, you know, term in other spaces, like in my wonderful colleague Ting Wang's work on Hui Muslims, where on the discourse of Mu Hei, zhengnengliang is also mobilized, right? So this is in the official discourse, but how does, you know, these official discourses, how is it also co-opted in other spaces of spaces of resistance or spaces of support for, you know, the government? And I mean, that just came to mind.
Zhengnengliang, positive energy, is definitely an instance of the productive dimension of censorship. It's on the face of it, right? It's not removing anything. It's not outlawing anything. It's about the promotion of positive messages, a greater spirit of whether it's camaraderie or ethnic harmony, right? But we could also view this as a form of censorship if we understand censorship as both destructive and formative. Zhengnengliang is seemingly a very innocent idea. I like to think of myself as an optimistic person, so if I had to pick, I would say I am, quote unquote, filled with positive energy too. But it's always this mobilization, a campaignization, if you will, of a loud form of speech that make it very suspicious. So on the behind the promotion of positive energy, there is at the same time, of course, the marginalization and the removal of energy that doesn't fit where the government wants it to go.
Yeah, the sanctioned energy.
Yes.
Yeah, and that also speaks to the collaborativeness, right, of censorship, but also propaganda in these, you know, in these spaces. And I just wanted you to touch on that because you push forward the term workshop, right, as a way of thinking about how censorship, but also propaganda, is co-created in a collaborative, you know, environment of parties that are sometimes even seemingly hold opposing views.
Nowadays, we tend to think everything is AI generated, where everything depends on algorithms. But what I hope to show with the concept of the workshop is that there is still so much human work, human labor done in the realm of censorship, whether that's in the work of counter censorship or monitors, officials who still in this age of, you know, algorithms still manually, so to speak, enforce boundaries on speech. And the idea of workshop is conducive to thinking of censorship in a collaborative manner, as you say. A workshop is something that multiple people, a lot of people participate in. And there is a back and forth to this creation, to this production. It's not one person making everything happen, but even people learning from each other, helping, quote unquote, each other to make things. And here I'm talking about not just our resistors, right? Not just the intellectuals, writers, and artists who learn from each other, who support each other in resisting censorship, but censors themselves, policies themselves are refined and they too learn from what's out there. So there is a mutual education at work here. You could think of it as a cat and mouse game, but at the same time, I think it's more instructive to think of it as mutual instruction almost, where the sensors too are learning the various new things that are being developed, and they're incorporating new strategies into how they approach discursive management. So it is very much mutually imbricated, and I want to emphasize the productive side with the concept of workshop.
Yeah, the workshop. And so can we consider the audiences or intended audiences as also an integral part of this workshop? And if so, would the intended audiences of what is considered subversive production shape or inform or influence these productions, both in terms of the narratives, but also in choice of form or choice of platform, you know, among others?
Absolutely. And of course, the government seeks to paint certain writers and filmmakers, artists, as writing, targeting a foreign audience, right? They want to paint these artists as currying Western favor, that they are completely colonizing themselves. They are serving these imperialist powers, right? Of course, the actual dynamic behind the scenes is they prevent these local intellectuals, writers, filmmakers from having that domestic audience by shutting the gates on them and really forcing them to have their works seen and read, to force them to turn to other venues, other channels and platforms. So we need to be cognizant of that. These artists would love to have a domestic readership and viewership, would love to have their films screened and exhibited, their works discussed openly, whether in the classroom or in salons, right? But they have to be diverted elsewhere. But such is the porousness of borders that, you know, these outside conversations do make their way into China as well. So there is feedback. There is a mechanism where more diverse productions are seen by Chinese readers and spectators.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, and in terms of competing narratives, also linked to, you know, what you were just talking about right now, the issue of the Tank Man, right? I think that's a very iconic one for people outside of China, right? but I think you do engage with the multiple narratives surrounding the Tank Man and the multiple symbolisms of that. I don't know if you could, you know, just touch a bit more on that.
Sure, Ignatius. You know, the Tank Man is the most reductive symbol out there,
right? Yeah.
And people use it as a shorthand for quite a few things. Oftentimes, it is brought up by journalists to as a symbol of censorship itself. They, you know, multiple people have done this. They go to Chinese campuses, university campuses, and they interview students and they show them the Tank Man picture. Do you recognize it? Do you know where, or you know, where is this? When was this taken? And more often than not, of course, the answer is no. We don't recognize this. We have no idea what this is about. And that's just simply taken at face value. It's interpreted as a sign that, yes, the regime has successfully erased Tiananmen from public discourse. The young generation, whether it's right now or the future, will have no idea what this event was all about. And it points to the success of this campaign of amnesia, right? But what is not taken into consideration is how these students may not want to avow knowledge of this picture, right? If I were a Chinese university student and a journalist suddenly asks me about this, I'm not going to show my hand, right? Even if I'm actually part of a group of activists. So what I want to do in my book, especially in the early chapters, is to reveal the complexity of that image and that moment too, and to show how the government in the immediate aftermath used it for its own purposes as a symbol of the forbearance of the father, right? That the tank not running over the student, trying to swerve, trying to get out of the way. And this brazen radical that keeps getting it in the way of the tank and keeps on provoking our kind soldiers, our benevolent soldiers. So that moment can be put to better use to illustrate how complex images can be, how different resonances can be drawn out of them and be put to different use. But of course, what's interesting about that clip as seen on Chinese television, right, as seen on Chinese, Central Chinese TV, is that later it became too provocative even for the official narrative. It too had to disappear, had to be, you know, scrubbed from the Chinese sphere.
Yeah, on the recasting of narratives, and which also feeds into, you know, a broader issue of political participation as well in many of the works that you analyze. And you say this explicitly, that political participation is seemingly replaced with sexual and commercial consumption, and that is reflected in some ways in some of the works that you, the films and literature that you analyze. And I was just wondering if you could reflect on that. And also in terms of how it fits into the broader rise of consumerism in the aftermath of Tiananmen in the 90s, in the late 80s and 90s.
Sure, Ignatius. You see this most evidently in the film Summer Palace. And in for the movie Summer Palace, it's often been read as a very depoliticized treatment of the protests. That the students, the college students, are shown to be simply dabbling in protest, right? What they really care about is having sex with one another, having a good time, going to parties, and there are not really politically committed. So in such a reading, this film actually supports the government narrative that these students are just immature. They didn't know what they were doing. They had their brains washed momentarily, right, by the fervent of the times. But because of the crackdown, we set China on the better path, the good path, taming these hedonistic energies. My chapter, on the other hand, seeks to show that it's because of the violence, because of the crackdown, and you hear the bullets in that film, that the political way of life is shut down, and it is the hedonism that's allowed to run more rampant. If you are buying things, if you are having sex, no problem. That we have no issues with that. As long as you don't engage in street protests, and as long as you don't challenge authority, right? So there is a different way of looking at the film Summer Palace that resuscitates its energies. So here we could think of the libidinal energies of the students as something emancipatory, as something revolutionary that had to be tamed and with violence, with gunfire. And then we have the 1990s depoliticization, where everything becomes money, 一切向前看, looking forward and looking at money too.
Yeah, I like how, you know, the polysemic readings of this this phrase, right? You know, Wang Qian and Wang Qian. That was very interesting. Yeah, that was an interesting one. And in all these works as well, I mean, I found that women played a major role in terms of the characters that were being portrayed, right? And so I was just wondering if that has anything to do with and how that fits into the broader, you know, Maoist rhetoric of, you know, female empowerment, women equality, and all of that. Because, I mean, in most of them, that was a trend that I could see, which was great.
Sure. And what really jumps out to me at the moment about this, on this topic, is in those works of government propaganda, it is male-dominated. We see masculinization or militarization of social life as depicted in these pamphlets and these works of reportage. Soldiers, once again, are lionized. They become martyrs, right? And it's their sacrifice that is supposed to wake up the entire populace. What is the role of women in such portrayals? Very much a subservient one of serving men, whether it's mothers at home who generously send their sons to the front lines, right? Or wives and fiancés and girlfriends who then mourn the death of these heroic figures. And towards the end of these, you know, many pieces, many such pieces, we have descriptions of their sisters or their girlfriends taking up the gun, being bestowed the gun of the army, right, and to continue the cause left behind by their dead brothers or their dead spouses, dead boyfriends. And in these portrayals, women function not in their own identity or sexuality. They are very much part of, you could say, a patriarchal conveyor belt, even just being conveyed into the system, the machine, as one more cog that is supposed to only behave patriotically, right? So on the surface, you could say that it is a kind of equality, women joining the military, right? But it's really not activating themselves, their true selves.
Yeah, and how does that compare? So the government productions, how does that compare with productions that were considered subversive?
Yes. So in these other works, these women are allowed their own voices.
Right.
And not in a government documentary, but in this would be a underground documentary I graduated, for instance. You have women interviewed, speaking to the camera in their own voices, telling the audience, you know, what they saw, what they witnessed, and also giving their views on a variety of subjects so that their beings are not instrumentalized. They're not reduced to serving a particular larger goal or larger function. They are allowed to talk about something as varied as study abroad or their sex lives or how do they see their future, right? Their full humanity is allowed to come into being rather than being forced, having their stories tailored to serve a single message.
Yeah, no, that's, and I just want to bring us back to, you know, the issue of form and platform that we talked about a bit earlier on. And so I was just thinking, with the increasing access to the internet in the 1990s, censorship moved online, right, gradually. And the cyberspace here is treated with logics of geopolitical space. Right. And with the aim of achieving internet sovereignty in China. And so I'm just beyond the overdetermined discussions on the Great Firewall of China. How has the internet, right, in the 90s, how did it shape censorship, if at all?
You know, the term internet sovereignty is a really interesting one. On the one hand, it seems to lend a lot of credence to Chinese government policy. Just like how sovereignty is something that so many nations strive for, right? So many nations that were the victims of imperialism and colonialism, they fought for sovereignty. And so, therefore, sovereignty is always a good thing. And when it applies to internet, it's understandable too, right? So that's what the term wants believers to think. But then when you actually look at the practices of the Chinese censorship regime, it's definitely not one of sovereignty. They do want to maintain sovereignty when it comes to its own territory, right? But on a international scale, it's very much an extraterritorial agenda that they're pushing. So sovereignty and self-determination on the one hand, but actually violating sovereignty, violating internet sovereignty, seeking to influence global discourse on the other, whether it's online, with TV, other forms of media. Censorship itself, it's founded on sovereignty, founded on its rules and regulations and laws, but at the same time, there's always this extraterritorial ambition to it that seeks to expand and conquer new territories, that seeks to replicate its regime elsewhere in other parts of the world to grant itself legitimacy.
Yeah, that's great. And so, I mean, I must say, though, that the prose is beautifully written, I mean, and captivating. When I was reading the book, I mean, I just couldn't put it down at multiple points in time, right? And so also there's this the issue of, you know, weaving in very different types of material, like literature, film, documentaries, into one coherent narrative, which you do beautifully. And what I'm just wondering is, and this is something that I do in my own work and that I am thinking about, is that what does looking across different forms or different types of material offer that looking at one kind doesn't? I mean, you could have just focused on literature, right? Or just on film or on documentaries. So,
in our training, we're always taught to be medium specific, and obviously for good reason. And studies that cross these different forms are always looked a little suspiciously at, right? Can one thing that applies to one medium really apply to another medium? So what I try to do with my book is to show two forces, both forces at play. There are things that cut across different media, different forms. For instance, rules and regulations that do apply no matter what the media. But then in the study, also attending to specificities and peculiarities of form. I'll give you one instance. In the aftermath of Tiananmen, the government produced a lot more literature, textbooks, pamphlets, things of that nature, so much more than audiovisual productions, videos, films. And it's because of the inherently multiplicity or an inherent multivocality of the audio image, both sound and pictures. Those things are much harder to tame and restrict and put to singular use than words, right? And so therefore, that is curtailed in this campaign. Today, if you go on Baidu and you search for sensitive terms, whether it's Tiananmen or some other terms, you'll always get more textual links than image choices. So images do come in for harsher treatment. And so I want to preserve the difference across these various media, right? But also trying to show larger forces that reverberate and cross-cut them as well.
Yeah, no, I found looking beyond and between these forms to be very generative. And you talk about your personal experiences with censorship in the book, right? And I would just love you to elaborate a little more on that.
I think for me, the most important thing in writing this book, one of the most important things is to be always self-cognizant and to be self-reflexive about my practice. And this book, even though it's published in the U.S., I'm a scholar working in the U.S., it's still shaped by censorship. Not in the expected sense of my visa being restricted or my materials that I want to take out of China getting stopped at the border. Nothing's like that. But in at least these ways, in the choice of subject matter to begin with, we would think that in the U.S., we enjoy complete academic freedom, and we do to a huge extent, an extent that you do not find in a lot of other places. Nevertheless, there are influences exerted by one's own advisors and with, of course, the best of intentions, right? Advisors who tell their students, well, this is definitely a touchy subject. For you as a grad student, maybe it's not the right idea. Maybe after tenure, then you can do this. Because if you embark on something like this right now, people are going to be afraid of you. Your colleagues in China are going to be afraid of you. Even if they love what you're doing, they'll be afraid to openly work with you, collaborate with you, invite you over. So a lot of opportunities are lost right from the get-go. So there are these considerations, right, that for a student to hear would tend to steer them away from these sensitive domains into ones that are less political, right? And that too is a subtle form of censorship in a way. It's not understood strictly in a negative restrictive sense of, okay, since Tiananmen off limits, but also in terms of shaping research agendas that otherwise would have more directions to go in, right? So that's one instance. And there are also instances of me publishing work from this book in China and getting particular passages, struck out and working with the translator and the editor to have a certain version be acceptable. So in these back and forths, I didn't want to leave them outside of the book. I wanted them to bring them into the book as part of the larger consideration. This is what happens when we write, engage, and deal with censorship. It's never just an external object that we study, that we can remain distant from, but it filters into our very practice, and it influences our intellectual formation.
As we draw towards the end of our conversation, I would like to just bring us back to the cover of the book, which I found very brilliantly captivates the main argument that you make in the book, right? So we have the redacted words and the re-inscribing of the words on the cover of the book. I mean, can you just talk about that?
I'm glad you like it, Ignatius. This cover has grown on me over time. I'm certainly appreciative of the design of this cover. It wasn't my first choice. My first choice was, and of course, I'm no graphic designer, nor am I in marketing, so I cannot make the final call in this area. But what I had conceived beforehand was having like a newspaper print completely covering the cover of the book, right? And with nearly all of the words blacked out with black marker, but only the words "Made in Censorship, the Tiananmen Movement in Chinese Literature and Film" left. So these words would be visible in different places. So it's somebody using what's already available to create the title of the book. But the team at Columbia decided, this is not very very sellable or very striking on the book stand. So this was agreed upon, and it has grown on me over time. Sure, it does. Does capture some of the central themes of the book.
Yes, I really like it. And so what should we expect from you next after this book?
I am working on something new. I'm not at a stage where I can share it publicly yet.
Right.
But I will say that, you know, as scholars, we are always drawn in at least two directions. On the one hand, you know, in the aftermath of publishing a book, there is a part of you that wants to keep on tilling this field, right? There are other things that I do want to write about censorship that I didn't get to, and other avenues I want to explore in relation to this, and I will pursue that. But the other force is to do something completely new, completely different, and to expand what your area of expertise is. And for my second book project, that's what I'll be trying to do. Something that really is challenging, something that takes me out of my comfort zone. And ultimately, that's why we aim for mundane things like tenure, right? So that we, after we, you know, we have it, we can be even bolder in the intellectual choices that we make. And that's what I hope to be engaged with for the years to come.
Yeah, and no, I really look forward to, you know, seeing what else comes out of it. Because, you know, as scholars as well, finishing a work offers as many answers as it does questions, right? For going on to different directions as well. Tom, thank you very much for making the time and for having this conversation with us. I'm really, really grateful. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Ignatius. It was a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to our Global Media and Communication podcast. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out through our email, cargc@asc.upenn.edu, or follow us on Twitter.
Until next time.